You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Beth Twitty is the mother of Natalie Holloway, a teen who disappeared during a school trip to Aruba and hasn't been heard from since. It's one of those stories that every parent just kind of cringes at because it's every parent's worst nightmare. And of course, the name and face of Natalie Holloway has been shown in various media reports all over the world. And for nearly 19 agonizing months, Beth has mourned her daughter's disappearance and shares with us today how this horrific tragedy that every parent dreads has affected her spiritual life and, well, pretty much just life in general. Please welcome to the Drew Marshall Show, Beth Twitty. Thanks for joining us, Beth. You've done a million of these, so I really do appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, Drew.
In doing the research on this, because I had to do a little more maybe than my American counterparts, your story has been showing up here a little bit, but nowhere near as much as down in the States. The first thing that strikes me is how much on the internet there is about this whole case. Does that not blow you away?
Gosh, well it does, Drew, and I'm continually amazed every day at just the sheer number of persons who are just, you know, dedicated and committed to staying with the case and trying to find some answers. It is pretty amazing.
Now, you and your husband are still living around Birmingham, is that right?
Yes, we live in Birmingham.
And your son, Matt, how old is he?
He is 18, so he's a senior this year.
You know, with everything that happened to your daughter, Natalie, has that changed the way you parent Matt?
You know, not really in some ways, but then, of course, I think that it's just inevitable that you will have, you know, of course, some changes, but I think for the most part, I've just tried to, you know, have Matt continue and not really getting him involved in the day-to-day activities because he is just so, you know, he is just about to embark on, you know, it's college year. You know, I just want everything to be as normal as I can, you know, for him. And I think all parents, you know, want that for their siblings.
Oh, for sure. For sure. But if Matt says something like, hey, Mom, I know this might be hard on you, but after I graduate high school, the whole class is going to go down to Jamaica for a week.
Well, you know, I'm sure that conversation will come up. But what I hope to, when Matt and I do have that subject and we do sit down, you know, we will do that together. And whether that's engaged through, you know, the foundation that I've established, and we'll go to it, make sure he has the correct information. And also, you know, I think that's a great opportunity for parents to sit down, especially, you know, if they're young males and young females, that, you know, the things that can go wrong, and just preparing them so that they will be ready in a crisis situation, you know, should that occur. So I think it can be done. I think we can make it safer, but it does take a good bit of homework.
All right. We are on the phone with Beth Twitty. Beth, with the amount of interviews that you've done, have you had many interviewers cross the line with you and ask you questions that you just sat there and went, I can't believe you seriously asked me that question?
You know, it's amazing that you asked me that, Drew. Do you know that has never happened 18 months? I tell you, the media has been absolutely terrific. They have been so respectful. And I wonder about that because I know some persons may not have had a good experience. But I think what happened with the media and myself is we kind of established a relationship, or being together in a foreign country and seeing how you're shut out and continually things are derailed and you see the challenges you face. They faced them just as I did. And I think that's why we just kind of got an unspoken respect for each other because of what we went through on the island with dealing with the government.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Natalie. I mean, that's one of the main reasons we've got you on the show today. We can't let her case, her memory, her life be forgotten. So let's press on. October 26th, 1986, your life changed forever. This little girl came into your life. Take us back to that time. I mean, this is your first child?
Yeah, Natalie's my first child, and just as with every mother and father, I mean, all your hopes and dreams are you know, right there with you. And, I mean, it's you can't imagine that being taken away from you. No one can. I never even thought about it. Never.
Was she an easy delivery, an easy birth?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, everything, you know, everything was fine. And there were, you know, it was just joy. And, of course, you know, it's the day you've waited for many, many years. And what happens is everything that you've hoped and dreamed for, you know. You know, you just don't think about, though, at that point, you're not thinking about anything could even possibly happen to you.
No.
To destroy any of that, to that hope or the dream that you have and the joy that you're feeling at that moment.
Hmm. Well, she had 18 years of living with you all. And I have a child, a son who's 17, a daughter who's 14. And as I look back over their life, they change. But I begin to pick up mega themes around 17, 18. I begin to look back in hindsight and see what kind of characteristics this child really has hung on to over the years. So kind of pinpointing and narrowing down a description of Natalie, what kind of characteristics would describe Natalie?
Well, the one thing I want to share with persons is that Natalie's Bible study leader, she shared this with me, I guess it was this summer, and I did not know this about my own daughter. And she told me that when Natalie had been with her, which I knew for the last 4 years, she'd been with her Bible study leader for her 4 years of high school. But what Donna Green shared with me was that Natalie was the only one in her high school group that had achieved 100% in Bible verse memory. And she was just never missed a Bible study group session. And, you know, she was just so dedicated, and she knew her God very well. And, you know, I think that, if I had to say one thing about my daughter, is, you know, it's something that I am so proud of her for that and still am to this day.
Hmm.
And I think that speaks volumes of the young lady that Natalie was.
Was she a practical joker? Was she serious? Was she athletic? Was she? I think she was a cheerleader. I saw some pictures where she had a cheerleading outfit on.
Yeah, she was. She was is on a high school dance team, and you know, these kids, these, you know, gosh, your sons and daughters that are in these extracurricular activities, whether it's football or, you know, a dance team, I mean, they have to be so committed, because it really takes a lot of work and commitment from, you know, from our young adults. And she was just, you know, dedicated her life to that. She'd been on this high school dance team for 4 years. And she was, loved her friends, absolutely loved her friends. But, you know, when it came time to the academic part, you know, she was just very serious and would be upset with herself if she made below an A. And there are lots of young adults who, you know, or that, just that driven and that motivated, and that's just who she was.
She had great grades as well. I mean, what kind of doctor would Natalie have been?
You know, I don't know. I think we talked about, and it's funny, we had talked about that somewhat. I think dermatology, and I think that all of them go through that phase of high school of thinking that, you know, dermatologists seem to always fascinate Natalie, and I think that would have fit her well. So that could have been something.
Hmm.
She would have delved into dermatology.
Yeah, I talk with a lot of people who have lost loved ones, especially children, and there's so many memory triggers, whether it be a smell or a sight of something or a store or a shop or a restaurant or something in the house. Are those? Can you share with us a couple of memory triggers that you have of Natalie?
You know, I don't really think that there's any one specific incident or when I reflect back on and think about, I don't think that as far as you know, my journey has been.
Hmm.
I think the most difficult tasks that you face are just every day. And, you know, you think about so many things of your son or daughter, you can't really focus on one, but, you know, there's just too many. But I think the biggest challenge I face, because I do think about Natalie every day, is just, you know, keeping that faith in action every single day. And I think that is probably the most difficult step along the way.
One of the scenes I saw of Natalie on the internet, some footage that I've seen, she had a ring on her ring finger. Was there any significance in that?
No, I don't know. They wear, you know, different pieces of jewelry. No significance
okay.
at all.
I didn't know whether it was like a promise ring or, you know, I don't know, she was engaged or she had a steady boyfriend or, I don't know, just something I saw.
No, Natalie had never had a, quote, boyfriend. She had a lot of friends, guys, girls, and they enjoyed doing things together, but as having a specific person, no, she never did. And, it just wasn't that, the timing just hadn't been right, and she just had a lot of friends.
Hmm. Well, she's been missing over a year and a half now. Beth, what's different in you now than when this horrific ordeal began? Have you looked back, hindsight, and sort of taken stock of how you've changed?
Well, I think the biggest change that has occurred in my life is when, as I mentioned, faith is I think that has just changed tremendously, and I think how I see everything now and how I feel about things in general, that has been just a tremendous spiritual journey for me. And it began early on, of course, on the island of Aruba, probably within the first few days of Natalie's disappearance. And I think what I've been able to draw upon is my foundation of faith. And what you do when you're faced with a tragic situation as an adult, I think you go back to a time in your life when there was peace and there was calmness, and that's what I did. And I went back to my foundation of faith with my parents. And at that time when we were in church and or whether we were, discussing, our views of God, and I think that's what I was able to draw upon. And I knew that when this happened with Natalie, I didn't know how I was going to get through it. I think you think that it's up to you, initially to pull through this, but once you can finally, realize that you've got to trust in God and lay your burdens there, I think it's only then when you can begin to move forward in this journey. And that's exactly what I did after Natalie was taken.
Well, I've just realized that some of our listeners may actually not be up to speed on the whole story up here in Canada. So I think we should probably bring them up to speed, and then maybe we'll come back to your spiritual journey just after that, if that's all right. Folks, we're speaking with Beth Twitty. And Beth, of course, is the mother of Natalie Holloway, who was the teen who disappeared during a school trip to Aruba over a year and a half ago. The first thing that comes to mind when I say the name Joren Vandersloot.
Well, the reaction is he is just one of the suspects that is involved into Natalie's disappearance. And that's it.
You don't have any malice. You don't hate the guy. You're not angry at him. You're not. You don't want to follow him around 24/7 to see when he slips up. I mean, if he really is the prime suspect, would you say he's the prime suspect?
He is, and that has been stated by the authorities on the island of Aruba that he is the prime suspect into Natalie's disappearance. And you go through a lot of emotions through this, but the way I look at it, Drew, this is a marathon that I'm in for whatever reason that might be, and I will know that one day, but I don't know it now, that you just have to really pace yourself, and you just have to look at each day and keep that faith in action every day that you will get answers. I mean, I've had to really learn to let go of what you can't control because, you will just be of no good to anyone. And sure, absolutely, that's been difficult. But I can do it, and each day I get through it is another day towards, moving forward in this journey. And
but Beth, when you read a quote or hear the quote that he says, well, it's in his statement. Natalie told me that her mother was the sister of Hitler. I laughed and did not ask her what she meant by that. She had said this to me about five times. I mean, there's got to be something that conjures up inside of you. I mean, was this the reason that there were reports that your relationship was strained with Natalie because of that one quote?
You know, it's so funny. There's been so much, so many things that, so many stories and so many tales that they have fabricated.
Right.
And so when you know it's not true,
you just laugh at it.
You don't even have to defend it. Well, I don't even, you know, I don't even laugh at it. If it's not true, then it doesn't require any energy from me to defend it. Now, I think if I, you know, of course, if somebody gets defensive or upset, then sometimes there can be some element of truth in it. But with this, and I think it's been, all of the elements have been so bizarre, and the stories that they've fabricated, and you just can't even let it, you know, it doesn't even, I mean, it doesn't even bother me, Drew.
No.
I mean, there's just no truth to it. And I just feel, it's almost as if they're just, you almost feel sorry for them, because they're almost as if they're a pathetic form of beings, and that they have to make defamatory remarks about their victim in order to try to make themselves feel better, you know?
Yeah.
So I almost look at them and it's kind of pathetic.
So you had absolutely no strain in the relationship there with Natalie whatsoever?
No.
And of course, that could be easily validated by all of her friends, because if Natalie was the social creature that I think she was, her friends were over at your place lots, and they knew you very, very well. So anybody could have come along and said, yeah, that's totally right.
Yeah, well, absolutely. They, you know, Natalie was with 154 classmates in Aruba, and you could have asked any of them, and absolutely no. And, gosh, I guess there were about 200 maybe and 90-something kids in her graduating class, and you could ask each one of them, too. So,
yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It's a moot point. Natalie had just graduated high school, folks. She was on her senior trip to Aruba with about 150 of her Mountain Brook classmates. There's got to be a point where you regretted letting her go.
You know, I don't, the way I look at it is, you don't really, I don't look at that I regretted letting her go. I do regret the fact that there are things that we need to do to prepare ourselves when we travel internationally. And I think the biggest, the most difficult issue that I faced was having to realize that, you know, your United States constitutional rights don't follow you with you. And so there is nothing for you should you find yourself in a crisis situation outside of your borders. And that's probably been the only, I had that false sense of security when Natalie left, that you could just pick up the phone and maybe call the State Department or, you know, call an embassy, maybe an American consulate, and they might respond or something. You know, but when that didn't happen until about the sixth day, you know, that was probably the hardest. That was probably the hardest pill for me to swallow. That was a hard life lesson to learn, that you are on your own. The family has to shoulder the complete financial, physically, you have to shoulder that burden. It's just, it's tough. It's a tough road to hoe, but you just got to do it.
Where was Natalie last seen? It was at the pub, Carlos and Charlie's, is that right?
Yes, it was.
And just to bring, again, our listeners up to speed, she'd just been having a party night there, no problems, you know, typical young person stuff. And then people had seen her leave with the three suspects, Vandersloot and is it Calpo brothers from Suriname? Is that how you pronounce their last name?
Yes, that's correct.
So they left in a taxi, and then after that, we don't know really what happened after that, right? So let's take us right back to that day, Monday, May 30th, just last year. You get a phone call, and what happens?
Right. Well, I get a phone call from one of the chaperones who'd organized the trip, and they told me that, you know, Natalie did not get on the plane. And, of course, in an instant, you know, they knew that she was going to be missing her flight. Well, once they called me, I knew in an instant that, you know, something terrible had happened. I mean, you know, Natalie was, you know, she was not only a very pretty young lady, but she was very intelligent. She was on her way to the University of Alabama on a full academic scholarship. So it was so out of character for her. She might be early for something, but there's no way she would ever be late for something. So, of course, I knew instant and began making my calls from the car. I was in a car coming home from an out-of-town family visit. I'd been with my mother, and you know, just began, just had to get in that mode of just, you know, began to see what I could do to help, because I knew that she was in serious trouble. You know, called the State Department, called the FBI, were making flight arrangements to get to Aruba. So I was in Aruba within, gosh, it was within, got the phone call at 12, and I was on the island at 11 p.m. that same day. So I got to the island within
12 hours. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It took some doing. And like I said, you know, you are pretty much on your own, and it's up to the parent to mobilize and to make it happen, to try to get to their young traveler when they're in a crisis situation. So, you know, it was difficult. And
so 12 hours later, you show up in Aruba, and had the class or all the classmates and the chaperones, had they left already? They were back in the States?
Yes, except for the chaperone, and we had discussed that. We really didn't feel as if it was a safe setting for these children to be in. So, you know, if we have one child that's disappearing, then something's wrong.
Right, so get the kids out of there. One chaperone stays behind. You show up, and would you go immediately to the police station?
No, because when you fly into a country like that, see, you don't, there's the question. You don't know where the police are, because this is information that's not available. So we did not know where the police were. The hotel had not told the chaperone who had been working with the hotel, the Holiday Inn Hotel, did not tell the chaperone that he was not even working with the police. So it's a real problem. I mean, just set that aside. It was it took me about 5 hours. About 3 a.m. I found the police.
Oh, wow.
And so they had been working with they're like beach patrol people, you know, but they neglected to tell them they weren't the police. So by the time we got to the police, then we had already contacted Natalie's friends to find out where she was last seen and what could have happened, and we found the suspects at one of the suspects' address, and we went to the home with the police, and that's when we began trying to, you know, trying to get the authorities to help us, but we were just recognizing quickly and rapidly that there was not going to be any help from them.
So you went to the Vandersloot home?
Yes, we did.
And how was Joran the first time you met him? Was there warning bells going off right away?
Well, of course there were warning bells. And, gosh, the things that he was describing that he did with Natalie in front of 8 eyewitnesses from our group from home were just, it was horrific. We could not believe, my husband was standing there, and I could not believe that they were admitting the things, the conduct that they had engaged in with Natalie in the car, and they were describing the condition that she was in. So things were terrible from the beginning.
Right. And now I've read the reports and what happened in the back of the car. But they were talking about just the back of the car. They weren't talking about anything else on the beach. I mean, because the original statement was, we drove Natalie back to the Holiday Inn.
Correct. And that's what they were doing after. That was the last thing they told my husband and the other eyewitnesses, that they dropped her off at the Holiday Inn Hotel, that she was so drunk, they said that she fell, stumbled, and she hit her head. And they just watched her get up, which is just, the whole thing is so bizarre, the story. And then the 2 security guards came up and helped her. Well, we all know that was the first original story that they fabricated with all of those elaborate details. So we've got a huge problem, and we all know that.
Hmm.
I mean, people don't make up stories in such detail as falling and hitting her head. So we began immediately thinking, you know, we're going to find her somehow with a head injury.
Right.
You know, is what we were thinking initially.
Right. Joran's father, he is a judge in Aruba, is that right?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was to be seated as a judge.
Do you think that had anything to do with the runaround you've been getting by the authorities in Aruba?
Well, absolutely it did. And he was very well connected with the chief of police, Jan van der Straten, who was involved into Natalie's involved in her investigation early on. They were closest friends, and they had worked, they were colleagues together. So we knew that there were a lot of payoffs and, you know, kickbacks coming, and we just didn't know how many there were, and evidently there are a lot.
Beth, who was the boy who asked her to get out of the car the night she left with the three suspects?
It was one of the Calpo brothers from Suriname that, of course, but we can't really... They fabricated 22 different versions of the story, so I hate to get too caught up in what they said because we know everything they've said so far has been a fabrication.
Oh, right. So nobody ever found the guy because the Calpo brothers were apparently in the front seat and Natalie and Joran were in the back seat, and as they were driving away, somebody in the parking lot apparently came up and tried
in
to say to her, get out of this car, what are you doing, you know, get out of the car, and then they drove off. Did we ever find out who that person was?
Yes, it is. I'm sorry, Drew. I misunderstood.
That's okay.
Yes, there was a classmate that was running out, you know, that could see the car leaving. But we have to remember now the taxis in Aruba, they're unmarked and they're privately owned vehicles, so it's very hard to discern which is a taxi which belongs to a local.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Were they in a taxi or were they in the Calpo's car?
Well, they were in one of the suspects' privately owned vehicle.
Right, right.
But it was so chaotic the night that the students were leaving because, you know, Carlos and Charlie said, you know, they get you in and they sell you as much liquor as they can.
Yeah.
But when it's closing time, they are ready to shove you out the door. So it was very chaotic. It was a mass exodus. And the kids were just really in a panic mode as to everybody clamoring to try to find cabs.
Yeah.
And so Natalie's friends believe that she thought that she was getting into a taxi to share a ride back to the Holiday Inn Hotel. Natalie had no idea she was getting into a privately owned vehicle by two locals on the island of Aruba. It was because it is just the transportation situation there is terrible.
Right, right.
How they get these tourists in their cars.
The lies going through the piles and I mean, just lie upon lie upon lie. 22 different versions of what happened. I mean, I only have done a little bit of research on this, Beth, but it was so obvious. I mean, here's Joran. That's how you pronounce his name, is it not?
Yes, Joran. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you're close. That's good.
Okay. Anyway, the Dutch guy. He has a VIP pass to the hippest bar in town, but he didn't know what a jelly shot was. Like, come on.
Well, the other thing that's so frustrating about this, Drew, is that John Vandersloot was also, he was only 17. And so it's for Carlos and Charlie to sell him and give him this VIP card so he has.
Oh, so he was totally underage.
Oh, yeah. And he also was an active gambler at the casino where he initially met Natalie. He and the father were there and met her initially that same night. They were seated at a casino table with Natalie.
Yeah.
So, and you're honest, yes, he was only 17 to be in the casinos and establishments where they're selling alcohol. So he was, yes, illegally there.
Do you, Beth, forgive me, there's a couple of little details and we'll move on to a little bit more depth in this, but does your family have a plantation?
No. No.
Because, again, reading through the reports filed by the police department and the interviews,
right.
I guess Vandersloot had said that Natalie had said her parents had a plantation and that to her black people were slaves and, you know, so there's no truth to that whatsoever. I just didn't know what your situation was. Maybe part of that was true, you know.
No, it's none of that is true. And, again, I think that a lot of times suspects, when they know they have committed this crime, they try to make as many defamatory remarks about their victim as possible because the victim is not here to defend themselves. So, you know what's so ironic about that? What is so ironic to me about how them trying to make Natalie out to be this person that they're, you know, fabricating or coming up with, it's here these three suspects, especially Joran Vandersloot, he's the one who single-handedly implicated the two innocent minority security guards.
Hmm.
So, you know, that speaks volumes. There's a real problem with their thinking on that island of Aruba. I mean, it's the mentality where the Dutch rule, and here they were going to let these two minority men go to prison for the rest of their life.
Yeah, there's no way a Dutch person could be held responsible for this on the island of Aruba. And I mean, as we all know, there has been issues of racism throughout the history of the Netherlands and on Aruba.
Well, I was just, when I saw Mickey John and Abraham Jones's faces when they were arrested, it just made me sick. Hmm. And, you know, because these suspects, you know, if I hadn't have just come unglued and just, you know, we knew what the island was doing. I mean, we spotted it in an instant, and I just couldn't believe it.
Yeah,
I couldn't believe that they were actually still in that mode. I just couldn't believe it. They could think they could get away with that. Horrible.
Beth, were you angry with your daughter at putting herself in such a dangerous situation? I mean, there's no question that this was the we have graduated high school. We're going to go to Aruba the last night. We're going to party. I'm sure she had some drinks. Or do you doubt that as well?
Well, just because you're leaving an establishment. And if you feel as if you're getting, I mean, a taxi, there's a big difference in leaving an establishment in a taxi.
Right.
And leaving one in a local's car. So, you know, all the students there were at such a disadvantage because, you know, you've really got to investigate the infrastructure of the country that you're visiting to find out the transportation system.
But even with her getting to the point, I mean, do you think, when you know your daughter, do you think that she would ever put herself in a situation where she had drank so much that she couldn't make good decisions?
No, and Natalie, it's funny that you mentioned that, and I have a photo of Natalie that was taken of her just shortly before the suspects took her from Carlos and Charlie's.
And she was in great condition in that photo, apparently.
Yes, oh yes. I mean, you know, I think it's, you know, the pictures of her, she's very much in control. Well, she's in total control, not very much. She is in total control. So you've got a problem if you've got a person who's in total control. And just an hour or so from that point, you're passing in and out of consciousness in a car. So yeah, we know that the suspects drugged her.
Oh, yeah, that sounds like the date rape drug for sure.
So, you know, it's not that Natalie was doing anything that she should not have been doing. You know, the main thing that broke down is just keeping your guard up, that there are people there, dangerous persons in dangerous places that have an agenda for you that you did not plan on. So, and they just got her.
Now, look, I know it's been a number of months, and I know you've had a lot of opportunity to process things and try to put things into perspective. But again, there must have been a time, where did your anger go? Were you angry at the chaperones? Like, what the heck were they doing?
You know, Drew, I just don't want to blame anyone. This is not, it is just,
there must have been a point. I know you've, as I said, you've processed things and you're at a better place now, but initially, if it was me and it was my son or my daughter what are chaperones supposed to be there for? They're the chaperone. And if there wasn't enough chaperones for 154 kids, there should have been more.
You know, Drew, I focused all of my energy was focused on seeing the problem that you go through in getting help in a crisis situation out of our borders, and not the blaming of the chaperones. Or I mean, you've got persons, they've got an agenda, and they're on that island, and they're the locals. I mean, there's no.
You could have 50 chaperones, and they're going to find a way around it.
Well, it absolutely. Things can happen like that, for sure. But that I think that where my frustration did come in was when you do find yourself in that situation, Drew. It's the frustration of the responsiveness of the victim's homeland. You there is nothing.
Right.
And that was the hardest lesson for me to learn. That was the most difficult hurdle that I faced.
Beth, do you think that it's worse? I'm sorry to ask you one of these questions, but I got to ask you because I'm trying to understand the process that you've gone through and relate this to other people's grief. And it's one of these comparison questions, and it's a fairly unfair question, but allow me to ask it anyway, and we'll leave it in your hands. Do you think it's worse having a child disappear or knowing that your child has been assaulted and murdered but being able to recover the body?
Well, I just can't answer it, and the reason why I can't is, you know, I'm in the parent's shoes who has a loved one that has been kidnapped, and, you know, we know it doesn't look good for Natalie. I mean, the suspects wouldn't have fabricated 22 stories. There's a reason. But, you know, Drew, I just can't say because I don't have the answer as to where her body is, and, I look at persons who have had, who've since recovered their loved one's body in a situation like this, and, you know, I'm just not there yet to tell you.
Yeah.
You know,
Because I keep thinking about the fact that because she's disappeared, because there's been no recovery of the body whatsoever, that means that there's still got to be a glimmer of hope that maybe she's, unfortunately, someone's hostage somewhere. And I think of that story recently where we just heard the girl who was held hostage for a number of years, who's just been released over in Ukraine somewhere over there. I can't remember exactly where it was, but... You could be walking down the street one day, Beth, and all of a sudden there's your daughter. These things play with your mind, and wouldn't it be just better to know the details and have found the body?
Well, of course parents want answers. They do. But, you know, and there's always hope for that. And I do have hope for that every day that I will have answers and I will know, you know, what happened. But I tell you something else that I've had to let go of, Drew, and believe me, it was not easy. I mean, I could not have told you what I'm about to tell you, gosh, within the first 6 months of this. But now what I have accepted is, and it's not easy, but you do have to begin to think about there's a possibility that your loved one's body may never be recovered. It may be unrecoverable. I mean, that's just been another hard hurdle. But, and they were trying to tell me that early on, even in summer of 05, like, you know, professionals, and I was like, I wouldn't even hear of it.
Right.
But there again, it's just a journey, and it's just a process. And, it may not happen, Drew. Yeah. I may not. But one thing I do, though, and I do believe it to this day, that I will find out what happened. I do believe that is coming.
Sure.
And, you know, I do.
Good for you. ScaredMonkeys.com. But who are these people?
I tell you, they've just been terrific. Actually, the person who maintains ScaredMonkeys.com would come to Aruba, and he would be flying in the helicopter, you know, blogging as he, you know, as things were unfolding. And they've just been great. There again.
So these guys are legitimate. They are sort of with you in putting together this website, trying to, and it's not just a website on Natalie. It's they cover a bunch of stories, but they're actually helping you with the continued search for Natalie.
Yes, and I can't take credit on helping them much. I'm telling you, those there's two men, and they are just absolutely terrific. They are so credible.
Hmm.
I trust them completely. We speak probably twice, two or three times a week. They're just absolutely phenomenal in getting the message out, keeping things out for missing persons, and they've just been absolutely awesome.
Beth, there's so much out there in the blogosphere that is just absolutely ripping you apart. What the heck is that all about?
Well, I don't know. I just don't pay any attention. There's, you know, for some reason, negativity. And I think, you know, that a lot of that, we got to remember, we're dealing with three different countries here. You know, you've got a lot of negative persons, and most of them are coming out of Aruba, so, which makes sense.
Hmm.
So they're going to want to defend, so I don't really pay any attention because they're just nameless faces. And, of course, anybody can make up anything, and you can say you're from the U.S., but you're blogging right out of Aruba, so those don't bother me.
It's really, the amount of information that's out there in this case is astounding, and the amount of opinions that people have, and you know, they say things like it's gospel truth, and, it, you know, I just go, where are you getting your facts from? Where are you getting your story from? Folks, we're actually speaking with Beth Twitty, who is the mother of Natalie Holloway, the teen who, of course, disappeared during a school trip to Aruba and hasn't been heard from or seen since. Forgiveness is something that we have to talk about, Beth. If it was me, I think everybody thinks this through. We put ourselves in your shoes and we go, okay, how would we handle this? Where does forgiveness come in? Are you able to forgive somebody who hasn't even admitted to doing it? Are you able to forgive the authorities? Are you able to forgive the Vandersloot family? Where does forgiveness fit into all this?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I think as far as forgiveness goes, I don't know what to forgive the suspects for yet, Drew. So, you know, I think I've still got a journey there. We don't know, okay? So we're looking for that. But, you know, as far as inexcusableness, I would have to look at the authorities, and that is inexcusable how their professionals react in a crisis situation. They need a lot of changes. They need to be looking. I don't think that I need to be looking at them to forgive them. They need to be looking at themselves, and they need to be reevaluating their law enforcement, their lack of law enforcement practices on the island of Aruba. That needs to take place first. You know, they've got a real problem on their hand. If they accept tourists on their island, you know, they accept their money, but they don't want to accept any responsibility, and that's a problem.
Wow. I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. And as a matter of fact, when we're finished with our time with you, Beth, and you've been just so gracious, so thanks again, we're going to ask our callers, if your child disappeared, do you think your faith could withstand it? Now, I want a little honesty here from you people. When we open up the phone lines, I want you to just imagine this. Think it through. Eventually, could you possibly even imagine yourself rejecting the reality of a God who hasn't even answered your gut-wrenching cries for help? Like maybe he wasn't there to begin with. And yet, I'm hearing something different from you, Beth. I'm hearing that this whole scenario has actually made you go back to the faith that you grew up in. Is that right?
Yes, it is. It is, Drew. It is. And with me, it did. And I have a lot of, I've reached out, and now I've had people reaching out to me that have had similar experiences that I have, and some are bitter. And some are angry, you know, and some, they may say, well, I hate angels. And I'm thinking, where was my son or daughter? And I'm thinking, well, you know, and they'll say, I envy your faith in this. And I said, well, you know, it's different for everyone. It's a hard journey. And, there's nobody said it would be easy, and you just can't prepare yourself for it. But, you know, I think that if you don't rely on all your strength to come from God, you can't do it.
What were you thinking when Dr. Schuller kept saying to you that he saw Jesus in your eyes?
You know, I think that he just sees that the spirit that I'm still remaining, keeping that trust and that hope alive, and that the hope is alive in me. And, you know, it is easy to give in to the pain. It's easy to let go of all the hope. But, you know, I just am not going to do it. Like I said, it's every day, and my challenges are just to keep my faith in action every day. And that's what I am just determined to do. And I do it because I feel it in my heart, and I have peace in my heart, and what a beautiful gift that I have, Drew.
But Beth, this is just me trying to process this. I'm struggling with this myself so much, and I have for many years. It's almost like a standing threat I have with God, if that makes any sense, where I say something along the lines of, look, I believe in you. I believe, Jesus, you are who you said you were. I've surrendered my life to you. I've asked for forgiveness. I'm in a restored relationship with the creator of the universe. Isn't this great? But if you allow anything like this to happen to one of my kids, I'm walking. And I know that's brutal faith. My faith is like a mile wide and a nickel deep. But do you get that? Do you understand like how, I guess what I'm trying to say ultimately is, it amazes me that you did not rage against a creator that would allow this sort of thing to happen to you and your family.
You know, Drew, and I think that what we did, God and I came to an understanding, and it was early into Natalie's disappearance. And the way that I truly feel is it's that acceptance, that trust agreement, okay? It's that unwritten agreement, that trust that, you know, if God trusted me to place her in my presence, that he, you know, trusted me, then when she is not in my presence, I trust him to care for her as equally as I did. And that is that trust. And if you don't have that, you can't function. I know that God is as proud of Natalie as I am. So that's where your trust comes into play. I mean, if I didn't believe that, then, you know, then yes, I would be bitter and I would be angry.
Beth, just coming into the end of this conversation, I want you to share with our listeners the story of the crosses you shared with Dr. Schuller.
Yes, and I think that's where all this happened. That was my experience that morning, and it was early into Natalie's disappearance. I had been awake for so long, days and nights were blending together, and and I was angry. I was angry. I was like, I was praying, and he just wasn't listening. God was not hearing me. And I'm thinking, okay, I've got to step it up. I've got to figure out how to pray harder and louder. And so I go to get a taxi, and the taxi cab driver, I just said, take me to a church or a chapel, take me somewhere. And he does, and he headed up to this, I could see the chapel in the distance, but as he was approaching it, there was a long line of just beautiful, large white crosses. And he stopped the cab and asked me to get out. And, of course, I didn't know what was going to happen, Drew. And as I was moving towards the cross, I just gazed at it for just a moment and fell to my knees. And that's when I began to pray. And it was just a long journey through these stations of the cross. But that's where I received my comfort, and that's when I received it. And, when I think back on I had never heard of the Stations of the Cross before, Drew. And, I know that, that now that they're not of biblical orientation. I mean, it's folklore. But they are very, that was where I had my, experience that morning. And that's when I think that when God and I came to this trust agreement that I was telling you about just a moment ago.
Yeah.
And that's when it happened.
Wow. That story kills me. That's why I get the standing ovation, I think, when you're in the Crystal Cathedral.
It's a very powerful morning. And
what do you miss about Natalie? Let's finish with that. Because there's got to be, again, imagining my own child disappearing. What do you miss about Natalie?
Well, if I had to say it, I think it depends on what time that you ask me that. And if you're asking me now, right now I tell you I miss her sophomore year in college. And I miss, right now we've got the Iron Bowl, we've got Alabama-Auburn playing today. It's just huge here.
Yeah.
And of course, Auburn University and University of Alabama. And I miss being at the University of Alabama with Natalie there during this game.
How can we pray for you?
Drew, they're already doing it. I have so much mail that I've received from persons in Canada, and what they're doing is what's carrying me through this journey, and they're just asking, they're asking God to give me comfort, and that's what they've done, and that's what sustained me. And and the next thing I'd love for them to do is just visit the website. Like I said, the marketing, they're from Canada, they're just fabulous. The website is really just it's one of a kind, nothing like it. It's www.safetravelsfoundation.org, and that's travels with an S. And we are really just wanting to try to help persons traveling internationally from all countries and to make every trip just a safer trip.
Beautiful. That's great. Beth Twitty, it has been an absolute pleasure hearing your heart on this. And when I think of you, I'll ask God to relentlessly pursue you.
Okay. Thank you, Drew.
Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye, Beth. There's part of me that doesn't like those kinds of interviews because it just hits too close to home for me. I think about my own child going through this, similar age, and I just, man, And that's what brought this next question into mind. If your child disappeared, do you think your faith could withstand it? I want a little honesty here, people. 905-338-1250. I want you to imagine this. Think it through. Eventually, could you even possibly imagine yourself rejecting the reality of a God who hasn't answered your gut-wrenching cries for help? Like maybe he wasn't even there to begin with. Do you think your faith could handle it, honestly? 905-338-1250. We'll take a short break, come back with your calls on The Drew Marshall Show. We'll be right back.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.